Travel back in time to the 80s, reliving the laughter. The heroes.
Pick up your phone and call the professionals. Ghostbusters.
And the honesty.
What's up, Norm?
My nipples, it's freezing out there.
Because just like you, we're stuck in the 80s.
Sure, it's not 1985 right now, but who knows what tomorrow will bring.
Hey, welcome to Stuck in the 80s. It's your old pal, Spearsy.
And Chuck Coverley in the Shadow of Philadelphia.
And today we are here to praise Hall & Oates, not to bury them.
You're Axel, I'm Slash.
No, Hall & Oates, you're like Peter Gabriel.
Hall & Oates is two separate people.
No, Holland is his first name and Oates is his last name.
Whatever, dude. I just want to kick ass.
This episode of Stuck in the 80s is sponsored by the 80s Cruise. Join your Stuck in the 80s hosts along with MTV VJs Mark Goodman and Alan Hunter in spring 2025 for a week-long trip aboard the Royal Caribbean Explorer of the Seas. Performers will include Squeeze, Adam Ant, Christopher Cross, Sheila E., Men at Work, Andy Bell of Erasure, Quiet Riot, Information Society, Curtis Blow, man, Honeymoon Suite, The Alarm, and more. Are you ready for the promo code? That's why you're really still listening, isn't it? For the first-time guests on the 80s Cruise, you can use the promo code STUCK, that's S-T-U-C-K, to get $200 in cabin credit. You have to be a first-time guest, and you will need to use the code when you book. Just point your favorite web browser to www.the80scruise.com for more information.
Newsflash, it's April 12th, and RollingStone.com publishes a story with the headline, John Oates is pretty sure Hall & Oates are never, ever getting back together again.
Hate that rock and roll rubbish.
Well, I'm afraid it's here to stay, Howie.
What?
Yeah. This ran online a few days ago. There's a bunch of important quotes from John Oates, half of all Hall & Oates, as we know. For example, he says he's tired of touring and playing the hits. He says, quote, I understand why people come and want to hear the big hits. Those songs are going to live forever, but I wanted to relegate them to the classic file that they're in, and I wanted them to be heard in the best possible light, the way they were when the spark was on fire in the 70s and 80s. That's when those songs really resonated. To keep playing them, for me, was no longer interesting. I wanted to do something else.
So I really can't disagree with that. Have you, you've seen them, right? You've seen them live in recent years?
Many, many times.
Yeah. And it's, you can almost tell, we saw them in right outside of Philadelphia in Camden, and Chubby Checker was there as well. He came out and sang with them, but I felt like phoning it in. I could describe it. Maybe it seemed Daryl was like fumbling over lyrics. He kind of just seemed not there. It was very disappointing. In fact, we left, and we hardly ever do that, but we left during the encore. It was not good.
I haven't paid to see them in concert in a while. It seems like I've seen a lot of free concerts of them, and I'm just shocked that they still tour every year. I don't know who hasn't seen them now.
Right. If you wanted to see them at some point along the last, 50 years, you would have gone to see them.
Yeah.
I don't know.
What were you waiting on? But anyway, John wasn't finished talking to Rolling Stone. He was really, He opened up a vein for us, is what I'd like to say.
Oh boy.
When he was asked about Daryl Hall, he said, and what Daryl Hall was up to these days, he said, quote, "Really, honestly, I don't follow him on social media. In fact, I don't even know what he's doing. I hope he's doing well, and I'm hoping he's having the time of his life, but it's not part of my life," unquote.
Wow. I mean, I do know that he's touring with Elvis Costello right at the moment. John doesn't know, apparently.
Here's the real quote that really gets the headlines. John Oates tells the magazine, I don't know why I call it a magazine. I mean, I guess they still do print.
It's an online magazine. Yeah.
I subscribe to it. You know, I paid like, I think it's $9 a month to read it. So anyway, quote, "As far as I'm concerned, I've moved on. I feel like I have a new lease on my creative life. Daryl Hall is an amazing individual. He is one of the great, great songwriters of all time. And without a doubt, one of the greatest singers of all time. I would never say anything negative about him, but we have a different strategy for our lives, and we have a different strategy for our business lives as well as our personal lives. And that's that. So be it. We're old guys. We deserve to be allowed to do whatever we want to do," unquote.
Absolutely. They paid their dues, right?
Yes.
At this point, you know, I think growing up, we always had the idea that they barbecued together with their families, that they hung out, like they lived together. You know, and then to come to realize that, no, they had their own lives separate. Yeah. You know, they came together to make the music. You know, they were work buddies and, you know, put out an incredible body of work, but they weren't so intertwined, you know, the way that we always thought they would be.
They formed it back in Philadelphia in 1970. I mean, you grew up in that area. I mean,
oh yeah.
How important were they to the music scene then?
They were huge already. It wasn't like the Hooters, you know, that were a local band that kind of worked their way up. By the time I was listening to music, they were already huge. You know, they were already big. But they were always billed here as Philly's Own. You know what I mean? So when they were playing a concert, you know, "Come see Philly's Own, Hall & Oates." So, you know, we knew they were from Philly. The story of that meeting, I think, is hysterical, that they were playing in the late 60s, like 67, I think it was, in West Philadelphia. They both had their own bands. And I know that, you know, they were fans of the same music. They loved all of that Philadelphia sound, all the Gamblin' Huff stuff, the Temptations, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Like they formed their musical sound around that Philly soul. And they were playing someplace. Well, there was a fight between rival gangs, and knives and baseball bats and gunshots rang out, and they went running to hide, and they both went into the same freight elevator and bumped into each other and introduced themselves. And that's how they met, which I think is hysterical. But you know, I'm so glad that they did meet, because who knows what would have happened if there wasn't a rumble and they both ended up playing, and who knows what would have happened.
Put them into context a little bit. First of all, they've always been adamant, by the way, about being called Daryl Hall and John Oates. They don't refer to themselves as Hall and Oates. That's what we do.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have time to Daryl Hall and John Oates. It's already a mouthful.
They scored in the U.S. top 40 with 29 of their 33 singles between 1974 and 1991.
Yeah.
If you want to look at their resume, they were inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2003. They were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2014. And to this day, they remain the most successful duo of all time, ahead of the Carpenters, the Everly Brothers, Simon and Garfunkel. If you go to the UK, I think they're still more successful there. But if you want to know, and this is my favorite trivia question of all time, what is the most prolific UK duo of all time? And you know the answer to that is?
I don't know.
Pet Shop Boys.
Oh yeah.
So
I was thinking too far back. That's recent. that's the 80s. That's like a decade or so ago. You have everything your heart desires.
So why you want more if you have everything your heart desires? You just still want more. You have everything your heart desires. Why do you want more if you have everything your heart desires?
So here's the million-dollar question. Is this breakup overdue?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I feel like there are certain acts that I feel just they kind of run their course. One that comes to mind, and I refuse to go see them because the last show that I saw them play was the best I've ever seen this band play. And they've been touring constantly for the last 55 years, and that's Chicago.
Wow.
They've never not been on tour. And, you know, there's only two guys left at this point, or maybe three, Lee Loughnane and Jimmy Penko and Robert Lamb. The rest are all just, you know, musicians that they pick up along the way. But at some point, you just got to say, hey, you know, call it quits, you know, and I feel like, especially after that last time that I saw them and I felt that they were just phoning it in.
Yes.
That had to be about 6 years ago or so, maybe, that I saw them in Camden. And I just felt like, yeah, they're done. But they kept on going. So a little bit overdue for me.
Here's the thing. And I was just thinking about this as you were talking about Chicago. We live in a time when so many amazing bands have yet to call it quits. The Rolling Stones are still out there.
Yeah.
The Who is still out there. As you said, Chicago is still out there. And then you get to bands like, Air Supply is coming up on 50 years. I think 38 Special is coming up on 40 years. The idea that a band stays together for 20 years and calls it quits, we're way beyond that.
So it's
like when Olivia Newton-John died, you're like, how could she die? She's going to live forever. I mean,
yeah.
In your mind, there's certain people that are going to live forever and they're never going to die and they're never going to break up. Like, you know, there's the Queen of England is going to live forever. She's going to outlive me. Yes.
They were constants in your life.
Yes.
That you can't imagine. Like, you don't remember a time when they did exist.
Right.
And you can't imagine them not existing.
Exactly. So the next question. So this is kind of hard to quantify. Is this happy news or is this sad news?
For me,
I guess it doesn't have to be one or the other.
Right. Because I'm right in the middle. I'm kind of like thinking I can see it. I don't see it as happy news, right? The ending of anything like this, you never want to say, okay, that's a happy thing. But their body of work, like it existed in the past anyway. Like, were they going to be putting out so many great new music? When was the last album that came out that you were just, you know, you couldn't wait to get home and put on, you know, that?
Oh yeah,
that,
no, it's been forever.
It's been forever. So, and I think that Change of Seasons, I think that might be the last album that I actually bought of theirs.
Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit more later on in the show about some of the later hits that we've forgotten.
Yeah.
But I see your point. When I think about other bands that broke up during our time, I mean, the Beatles broke up. We were too young to remember that. Bands that we might have loved that broke up, like REM, maybe they were around for what, maybe 20 years, maybe a little less. I felt sad, but I never saw them live, and that made me depressed. But
yeah, I mean, if they somehow came back together and decided to do a reunion tour, I'd probably want to see them. I mean, they had enough songs, they had enough music, their body of work was enough that I'd want to see them. The B-52s, they're calling it quits, right? Or are they still going?
They say they are, but they're doing right now, I think, Vegas, one of those like little
residences. Bill Collins, I just heard, is doing one of those, right?
What?
Yes.
No, I didn't hear that. Wow.
So Anne Marie just told me, she said that she saw something that said Phil Collins is going to be doing a residency in Vegas. And I was like, I thought that he was going to be somebody that we lost this year. Cause wasn't he like
Oh yeah, he can barely walk.
His biography was like, "I'm not dead yet," right? And I'm like, "Well, he's not that far off." At this, I'm not sure. You know, is he telling us something? What's going on? But that we might have to check some news on that to see, because I hope she wasn't.
I might have to check that. Okay,
sorry.
Final question: what other bands need to pull a Hall & Oates and retire right now?
Oh, we already said Chicago for sure.
I'm going to say Journey. Journey's down to basically one original member, two if you count Jonathan Cain, who joined them in the 80s. You basically have two original members who allegedly don't even talk to each other anymore. So
they're just going on stage and just really going through the motions, providing backing karaoke for Arnel Pineda.
Correct. And what kills me is, just like Hall & Oates, they're touring every damn year. Why? Yeah. I mean, I got to check myself, because this is where we get into trouble. Because we say these kind of things, and then people who listen to the podcasts will write a review saying all we do is dump on the 80s. Don't get me wrong. I loved Journey during their heyday. You know, I owned every one of their big albums from, I don't know, Evolution, Rue, Raised on Radio. And I think I even owned a couple of their newer ones when Arnell joined. But there just comes a time when you sort of have to say, you know.
Yeah.
As fate would have it, back in 2009, we did talk to John Oates. He and Daryl Hall were touring. They were about to do a show in Clearwater, Florida. Sean Daly, who is the host, the co-host of mine at Stuck in 80s at the time, we both did this interview. If I recall, it was mainly Sean. I think it was still early on in my days of trying to get my feet wet, you know, trying to feel comfortable doing an interview. So sit back and enjoy this 2009 interview with John Oates, and we'll be back after this with the Sunkies.
Hey, John, you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hey, this is Sean Daly. I'm the music critic at the St. Pete Times, and I'm with Steve Spears, an editor at TampaBay.com. Are you in Florida today?
I am. Yeah, we're up in northern Florida. We're up by Jacksonville.
Excellent. Excellent. Are you going to go to the beach or anything?
Yeah, we have actually a day off today, which is nice. We'll be on the beach, and we're looking forward to coming down your way and spending a couple more days on the beach.
Yes, that's right. April 15th, you and Daryl are at Ruth Eckerd Hall in Clearwater.
Yep.
It's a little chilly now, but hopefully by the time you're here, it'll be warmer.
Yeah, it's supposed to be nice. It's okay for us. We just spent a long winter in Colorado, so anything is good. We're happy.
Where are you guys living these days?
Well, we live in Colorado. I've been out with the family for 20 years now.
Really? Do you still have any sort of ties in Philly or anything?
Only my parents. Philadelphia area still. But no, not really. Other than that, not really.
That's good, because we're furious with Philadelphia these days because you guys kicked our ass in the World Series.
Well, I know. I sang the national anthem on that crazy game where it got postponed.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So you put the jinx on us.
Yeah, you're the reason we lost.
I am the reason we lost. I'm absolutely 100% responsible for that.
Well, listen, John, we're huge fans of you guys, and I mean, we were both raised on your music, and Steve and I have been working together for about 3 years now, and we already hate each other's guts, and yet you and Daryl have been together for 4 decades now.
So
we need some relationship advice. What is your secret to a long lasting relationship?
Oh boy, I'll tell you what—it's a very strange thing, you know. Duos in general have a very unusual dynamic, and it's always, you know, it's very hard. It's a question that's been asked to me so many times. I have to say that I think the reason it has to do with the fact that we grew up on the same kind of music. We have the exact same backgrounds when it comes to our you know, really when we were really young, before we even met. You know, we went to the same kind of schools, lived in the same part of Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia. We listened to the same kind of music. We were excited and inspired by the same type of music. And then when we got together, that formed like a musical bond, I think, that is really just a very, very solid kind of way that we relate musically on a lot of levels. But at the same time, to put that in contrast, we're so different as people. We're completely different. I mean, we couldn't be any more different in so many ways on the personal side that I think we balance each other out in a kind of a strange, weird way. And I guess there you go into the yin yang thing, kind of you know, as a you know, I guess that's a symbolic way of talking about it. And in a way, that's the best I can do, really.
Now, throughout the years, especially recently, you've each had your own solo projects. And last year you came out with a very excellent solo album called A Thousand Miles of Life.
Yes.
And I downloaded it last night and I was listening to it at home. I was really taken by the song Ghost Town about New Orleans.
Yeah.
How often have you been there often since Hurricane Katrina?
No, not often, but I have. I was there the first time was about a year and a half after the hurricane. And one of the things that struck me the most was the fact that I had a friend who lived in the neighborhoods outside of the French Quarter. And, you know, the French Quarter, they got back on their feet pretty quick because, you know, that's where all the people and tourists go and everything. And, you know, they kind of got that looking good and back up and running. But some of the neighborhoods and the places outside the French Quarter really were just totally, a year and a half after the hurricane, were still completely in shambles and just a complete wreck, you know. And it was kind of weird to me that in an American city, that much time could go by and no one would do anything about it. And it really showed me that, you know, it kind of struck my heart in that the, you know, the disenfranchised in this country, you know, don't necessarily get the same deal as a lot of other people. And it really bothered me. And I started, that's where that song came from. And what I try to do musically with that song is I try to create that eerie kind of New Orleans funeral march and, you know, kind of to give it like this atmospheric thing. I really wanted to set the feeling of New Orleans and give it that feeling. And I was really lucky to have John Popper play on that from Blues Traveler, and also the banjo on that is Bela Fleck, the great banjo player who's so amazing. And I just had such great musicians on that album, so it was really a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, you have Jerry Douglas, right? The great dobro player.
Yeah. Jerry Douglas and Sam Bush. I mean, I'm going to go name drop all over the place. You know,
so right.
Steve Cropper's playing on it, and Bonnie Bramlett and Becca Bramlett, you know, Jimmy Wayne. Just so many great people are on the album. So.
Love's lost and it can't be found. I'm living in a ghost town. Not a sympathetic soul around. I see the water rising. The wind and rain keeps driving me down. I'm living in a ghost town.
Hey, when you make a solo album, do you ever have that kind of the phantom limb experience? Like, does it feel weird? Are you missing your boy Daryl at all? Or how does that work?
No, not at all. I mean, especially on this album. This album was so different than the stuff I'm doing with Daryl or have done with Daryl. I mean, you know, I did it in Nashville. I did it in a real classic, old-school Nashville session style, you know, where I handpicked the musicians, created a rhythm section. We all sat in the room. We looked at each other. We played the songs, and that was it. Tracks were done. We moved on. So it was great. I really wanted to do that. We even picked an old studio from the 70s to do it in, Ronnie Millsap's studio, old studio. And so the vibe was very kind of old school in approach, but, you know, state of the art in terms of the way we recorded and everything. I hired a really great old school engineer as well to really capture that band, you know, live band in the studio sound.
You must have been thinking, what have I been doing all these years? I should have gone solo a long time ago.
Oh, no, it's not that. You know, I mean, what I do with Daryl is unique, and we can never replicate it or replace it. It's something special that just happens when he and I get together. The solo stuff, whether it's him or me, is totally different, you know, and it's like that gives us a chance to express ourselves in a different way. So I think they both have their place, and I think it's fun to be able to have both.
I haven't seen you guys play live since the H2O tour back in the early 80s when you played down here in St. Petersburg at the old Bayfront Center, which is long gone now. And for that tour, I remember you had one of the most incredible, you know, backing set of musicians I'd ever seen. You know, you had G.E. Smith on guitar, you know, T-Bone Walk on bass. It was an amazing show, and I went into that thinking I only knew, like, stuff off of H2O, but, man, that was like an educational concert. I think it went...
Educational concert, yes. That's our job. We are the nutty professors of pop music. you know what? Then be prepared to go to graduate school on the next show, then, because we are we're better now.
I'm a family man, and my father.
ask you real quick, going back to, like, you guys talk about how you and Daryl have that magic together. Going back to, like, the 70s, 80s, and 90s, where everything you guys touched, everything turned to gold. You know, just tell us a little about the creative process with you two, especially back then where it was just like, oh, my God. I mean, you guys were like Michael Jordan. I mean, everything you guys did was great, was brilliant.
Well, you know, in the 70s, I think really the 70s, the entire decade, if you look at the type of albums we put out and how they, you know, what they sounded like, I think it was a period of experimentation. You know, you look at the first three albums, Whole Oats, Band of Lunch, War Babies, they were completely different. Whole Oats was very singer-songwriter, very organic. A Band of Luncheonette was kind of this blending of kind of acoustic songwriter and R&B, and then War Babies was a full rock experiment album with Todd Rundgren. And you take those three albums, and if you combine them together, you get really what we ended up finally creating as our own, you know, original sound. And throughout the 70s, I think we dabbled in a lot of different styles to try to find ourselves. And then the 80s, it kind of came together. We produced ourselves, the hits started rolling. It was just an intense time where we would just, we would write songs really fast, we would record them fairly quickly, we'd get on a bus, we'd make videos, get on a bus, go on tour for a year, come back and do it all over again. And it never really stopped, and it never stopped for years and years and years. So it was just a crazy intense time, really hard to put into words, because it seemed like it just flew by. It seemed like it was like on fast forward all the time.
Now, you wrote Maneater, which I believe is still your best-selling hit. I actually saw you all perform it the other night on Dancing with the Stars.
Danceable. You notice I was only tapping my toes. I wasn't jumping into that world. I got the idea for Maneater, and I started Maneater. I wrote the chorus of it and had this, you know, what I thought was a really cool hook, which obviously I was right. And then Daryl and I got together and finished it, and we wrote the verses together. So that was one of those songs that really came out of living in New York in the 80s. It was a real New York 80s song. It was about the people that we were, you know, meeting and, you know, were hanging out with, and that kind of, you know, greedy kind of, you know, me first, the guy, you know, the one that dies with the most toys wins kind of concept.
Right.
And that's where that song came from.
Now, I read in an interview somewhere that you had originally wanted to sing that song instead of Daryl. What happened?
Well, I came to my senses, pretty much. You know, what we used to do is pretty much, you know, if one of us generated a song, then that was the person that usually sang it. But at that time, all the hits, Daryl was the voice of all the hits. And the record company put some pressure on us. And, they, you know, it was one of those things where, being a partner, I guess I had to act like a partner and do what was best for the general, you know, the partnership and the whole in general. And basically, the thing where I realized that if I sang it, it was going to be a hit of some sort, but it might not be a best match. And that's what happened.
Hey, coming back to the April 15th date at Ruth Eckert Hall, you guys are calling this tour Up Close and Personal.
Mm-hmm.
How does this differ from, like, previous tours? What are we going to see? Give us a tease.
Well, you know, when you're in a place like Ruth Eckert Hall, first of all, it is up close and personal. That's one of the nice things about playing. We've played it many times, and it's a great room.
It's
a room where I think our fans enjoy going because they're comfortable, they can hear the music, it sounds good, and that's really what it's all about for us. We did a show at the Troubadour Club in L.A. About a year ago, and that was kind of a return to our first venue that we ever played in Los Angeles back in the early 70s. So we decided to pull out a bunch of abandoned luncheonette songs and kind of go into the spirit of this type of show that we would have done back in those early 70s. And people really loved it, so we decided to take that on tour this year. So we're trying to replicate the spirit of that, those early 70s shows, and we do a lot of abandoned luncheonette material.
And you're pulling out some deep album cuts, right?
Well, you know, the Abandoned Luncheonette was always an album that was a fan favorite over the years. And people always talk about it. They've always loved it. It was an album that really meant a lot to a lot of people. So going back to that album and you know, and leaning on that a little bit more gives the show a whole different feel. Not to say that we don't play the 80s hits and stuff like that, because we do. But it just, and it's interesting for us, too, because it makes it fun for us to play new material.
Sarah's off on a turnaround, flying gambling fools to the Holy Land, Las Vegas. Sometimes she's here and sometimes she can't be found. Turn around.
Hey, John, you have a lot of, like, hip-hop stars seem to love you guys, and they're always sampling your songs. I think Biggie's Notorious B.I.G. sampled I Can't Go For That. How do you how do you feel about that?
I think it's amazing. I think whenever someone does that, I think they're in essence, they're honoring you in a way, because it shows that whatever it is that we did, with their elements of that, those grooves and those vibes, were influential to a new generation of songwriters and musicians. So to me, it's an honor, and I think it's amazing. And I love to hear how people interpret our original stuff and where they take it. And I think it's cool. It's the way of the world, you know. It's a new style of pop music, and we form kind of more of a foundation of the original pop that gave birth to whatever's going on today.
You know, I always thought that Every Time You Go Away was always a Paul Young original until I heard your original version.
Mm-hmm.
You've obviously heard both versions. And what do you think of his take on that? I mean, that's an 80s classic in a way.
The version we did on the Voices album, we did it specifically because we both heard it like a Memphis, like kind of like an Otis Redding, a Sam and Dave style song. And we did it on the Voices album in that style. If you listen to the original version, it's got B3 organ, it's really organic, and it's kind of this old, kind of retro R&B take on that song. What Paul Young and Paul Young's producers did with that is turned it into a really great pop song. And I give them credit for hearing it in the way they heard it and turning a really good song into a big hit because of the way they produced it and the style of the record they made. I still like our original version because I think it's more rootsy and more real, but at the same time, you can't deny that Paul Young's version was just a better pop song.
All right, John, I have two things left. One, I want to put in a request for Bank of Your Love, my favorite Hall & Oates song from Out of Touch.
Won't hear it.
Why don't you like that? Don't do that to me. It's like my most played song on my iPod.
It's not that we don't like it. We just don't know it.
Oh, really?
You have to remember, we have about 400 songs.
Oh, I know.
And the band can only play a certain amount of them. And we have about 50 songs in our repertoire, which is pretty darn good. But we can't do everything. And that's one we have not done yet. So,
well,
sorry.
Thank you for being coldly honest with me and buzzering me. And finally, we've saved it to the very end, out of respect for you and your upper lip. Why are people so obsessed with John Oates' mustache?
Because they're crazy. That's why. It's become a thing. I don't know. I guess the mustache is like this kind of iconic symbol of the 70s and the 80s. And that mustache that I had, it was seen so many times in the pictures and the photos and the videos. And, you know, the fact that the mustache is kind of back with a younger generation,
right?
People, it's kind of like a hip thing to have a mustache again. So I guess people look back to the early days of the mustache, and there's been a lot of talk about that. There's actually a guy who has a website who does pictures of me with the mustache in these really strange strange ways. So I don't know. It's just a thing. But it's gone. It's been gone for 18 years.
18 years? Kind of really? 18
years? I shaved it off in 1990.
It's the mustache.
It ain't coming back. I don't think I'd look too cool with a white mustache. Might look a little strange.
Good point. Well, we can't wait to see you April 15th at Ruth Eckert Hall. We'll be there. Sean promises he will not be yelling out that song title.
Yeah, I promise.
He can yell it out all he wants, but
you'll know it's me at least.
That's right. I'll know who it is.
Hey, thanks so much, John.
All right, man.
All right. See you soon. Talk
to you guys.
There you go, John Oates from 2009. We really cover a lot of territory in that interview.
That's a fun interview. I enjoyed that.
He was a great guy to talk to. I don't think I've ever met him in person. And
the talk about it takes me back to 2008 when the Phillies won the World Series, beat up on those Rays.
That's still a sore spot.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's okay. Well, what was so sore spot about it was I know that those people from Tampa Bay who traveled to Philadelphia to watch the games got mistreated pretty
well,
badly.
You go to Philly. It's famously, you know, but it's not always like that. You know, so we go to a game in Philadelphia. First game I take Anne-Marie to, and she grew up in Georgia. You know, she's from Savannah, Georgia. So they root for the, what's that team down
Braves.
In Atlanta? I don't
I love the Braves. God bless the Atlanta Braves.
I like the Braves back in the 80s when we had the, you know, TBS Superstation on early cable and we got all the games on that. But she wanted to wear her Braves hat. And I'm like, no, you cannot do that. She's like, why? And I'm like, you just can't. You can't do that. And, you know, it's nothing would happen to her, you know, but still I was like, no, let's leave the hat at home.
You know what I have tickets to?
The Seggies.
What's happening, hot stuff?
By the sound of the gong, it's time for Mystery Movie Moment. We'll play a snippet of a movie from the 80s if you get it right. You're entered into the drawing for the postal-friendly bottle opener. Brad in L.A. is currently now Brad in Las Vegas on a work trip, he says.
Wow.
So that explains why Chuck is here. And
whatever happens in Vegas, of course, will stay in Vegas.
I know Brad really well after, you know, a decade working together. And I guarantee you the worst trouble he's going to get into is he's going to go to the Golden Steer Steakhouse, which he loves dearly. It's like that old school Frank Sinatra steakhouse. He took me there once.
Is that the old part or is it the new part?
It's the old part.
Yeah.
It's somewhere like it's off the beaten path. You got to take a cab there unless he has a rental car. But, he's going to go there for a dinner. He's going to drink too much red wine. He's going to lace that with a few martinis. He'll start using profanity every other word, but that's when you know Brad's drunk, hammered, is starts dropping the F-bomb every three words. And until he starts doing that, he's okay.
He's not there.
Yeah. When he starts doing that, that's when you know you need to start handing him bottles of water in between drinks. So that'll happen one night this week, I'm sure. And I might get a text. I'll probably get a text with a couple of pictures of like a half empty wine bottle or something like that. If he does, I'll put it on the Patreon page. But when he finally gets back to LA, hopefully he'll mail off some of these postal friendly bottle openers. That was the whole point of that aside. Anyway, pay attention from episode 698. And unlike last episode, I now know there's a problem, and I now know the answer is 698. From 698, here was the mystery movie moment.
Come on, Neil. You learn what it's like to fire an employee.
Yep, that's Dirty Dancing. That came during our Rad episode. So,
What was the clip?
It was the clip of the guy who owns Kellerman's. Because he's the villain in Rad.
Oh.
So, and I even kind of hinted at that earlier in the podcast. Hey, you know, you probably know this guy better from Dirty Dancing. And then I play a clip and you know, I get it. An episode on Rad was probably not real high on the list of.
I probably have not seen that movie since it was out. I really haven't seen that in such a long time. I should put it on my list. I have a list of 80s movies I need to rediscover or revisit. And Rad is sitting squarely somewhere in the middle of that list.
Yeah, it's okay if you want to move a little lower.
Anyway, we just lost. I'm sorry. Damn. See, I'm ADD and all over the place.
That's okay.
Louis Gossett Jr., right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, are you going to do an episode talking about
We did that great episode on Iron Eagle.
Yeah.
And I reposted it. God, I wouldn't mind doing an episode about Enemy Mine.
Because Enemy Mine, yeah, that Enemy Mine is one of those movies that I could go back and I could watch it, you know, just put it on in the background when I'm doing stuff.
You and me, like, why don't we do an episode and we'll do Enemy Mine versus Officer and a Gentleman.
Yeah, and I'll wear my Zerky-proof hat.
Don't forget what you said about Mickey Mouse.
That's right, Mickey Mouse. Great. What a great movie. And it's so underrated too. It's never on those lists, I think.
Uncle.
Oh, you uncle. Of course we know who you are. You're uncle.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Let's do Sebby's. let's do Enemy Mine versus
Sebby's.
Enemy Mine versus Officer and a Gentleman. That's a good one.
Yeah.
We got some winners. You're going to have to read them.
I got to spin the wheel first.
No, we haven't named the winners.
Oh, no, haven't named who the people are. Okay, here we go. So winners include Andrea, not Andrea Crava, Jeff King, Sean Myberg from Doha, Pensacola Jim, Rhonda Presley, and Edmund Oklahoma, who was rocking an SIT80 shirt when she ran the Rock and Roll 5K in Las Vegas at the end of February, James in Michigan, and Jan Stuck in Lawrence, Kansas.
Pay attention. Here's this week's mystery movie clip.
Look, all you gotta do is wake up.
Wake up.
That's right. Wake up. Try. Concentrate. Wake up.
They gave me a sedative.
Sedative? Well, we're just gonna have to ride this out till it wears off.
If you know it, email us at podcast@sit80s.com. Tune in soon to find out if you're a winner. the mystical refrain that is Name That 80s Tune. We will play a tiny piece, a wafer thin mint of a song from the 80s. If you get it right, you're entered into the drawing for the postal friendly bottle opener when Brad gets back to LA. He's stuck in New York for like 2 more months at least. And then I think ultimately 4 more years.
Wow.
So just to put things in perspective.
With a little Vegas thrown in just for kicks.
Yeah. I mean, he gets to go home about once every other month. And then the wife comes to visit him every other month so that they kind of alternate so that they don't spend too much time apart. This is where the confusion happened in the last episode. It's all my fault because I used this song for 2 different clues. This was a backwards song clue, and this was a mystery, and this was a Name That 80s Tune clue. And I'm too stupid, or I keep notes, you know, and I somehow screwed it up. Last show I said, I don't know if this is from 695 or 698. Well, it's in both shows. And to that end, we'll be picking 2 winners this week.
Wow.
to get the swag. So pay attention, from 698. Here was the mystery song. That's Freakazoid by Midnight Star.
How good were they on the ship?
You know, it's funny. I was sitting next to your wife.
Oh, yeah.
Because she found the secret hidden chair. There's a secret hidden bench in the venue.
That's right. Right near the bar.
Right near the bar, but still like nobody around you to bug you. And so she and I sat there and watched the first couple songs for Midnight Star, I think on the first performance. So
And
they opened with Freakazoid.
Yeah, and they wrote a bunch of other songs for other artists, and they did that little medley. Every time they would do a new song, we're like, oh wow, didn't know they did that one either. Wow, that's like fun. You're rock steady, we're rocking the Whispers. I was back there rocking. Judy got video of me back there rocking, posted it on Facebook. I don't care. I'm happy. I'm rocking.
It's easy to find you in a crowd because you're so tall. I don't think people realize you're what? 7'6". Still 7'4". I mean, 6'4" is pretty tall.
Yeah.
Okay, we got some winners again. These people might have gotten the previous clue right. These are the exact same names, because when I do a search, I do a search for Freakazoid, and I see all the names pop up. So you might have gotten it right for Backward Song. You might have gotten it right for this. We're going to say your name anyway. or
maybe
or
for both. Who knows?
Chuck's going to say your name anyway.
Winners this week include Amy Lynn, John Ross from Charlotte, North Carolina, Cliff from somewhere north of Detroit, Donnie Vacoder, Bluefess from San Diego, Lou, Sweet Lou Grilly, Plane Pulling Tom, Lee from hashtag San Francisco Bay Area 80s Cruisers. Hi, Lee. Todd Cunningham, Richard the Big Bunny, Auburn in Tennessee, and Todd in Minnesota.
Yep. I keep asking Cliff, I emailed him, I think, this week saying, where north of Detroit?
Could be.
He's not answering.
All of Canada. Who knows?
Yeah. So we'll see. Maybe he'll answer. Okay. Now we get to spin the wheel and we're going to pick two winners. How that's going to happen, don't worry about it. If you think there's actually a wheel here, it's time to re-examine your life choices.
I'm still going to pull it. You ready? One, two, three.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, that's how you do it.
I guess I've written I wrote in two names on every slot. That's how I did it. Looks like it's going to land on Pensacola Jim and Rhonda Presley in Edmond, Oklahoma. So send us your postal addresses and we will send you some swag. In the meantime, pay attention. This is not a song by Midnight Star. If you know it, email us at podcast@sit80s.com and tune in soon to find out if you're a winner. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. I'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company.
It's the real thing.
I'd like to teach the world
what the world wants to hear.
And we're back. We thought, hey, instead of giving you a list of our top five 80s songs by Hall & Oates, because you know what they would be.
Yeah.
We thought let's honor the legacy of this amazing duo by talking about a couple of their songs that were, you know, decent hits, but much later in their career. And I want to start with this 1990 song from the album Change of Season. That's so close. Man, I love that song.
It's a great tune. It's one that I had kind of forgotten about, you know, and then I told Alexa the other day to play it. And I'm like, man, I really like that album. That was the last album that I bought when I was really looking forward to getting a Hall & Oates album. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, oh yeah, like, you know, and Big Bang Boom and H2O were ones that, you know, but then this was the last album, I think, that I bought. And played the hell out of it. What a great tune.
Written by Daryl Hall and George Green, co-produced by John Bon Jovi. Weird.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Weirdly enough, it got mixed reviews from the music critics. Music critics, I'm sure, have been a little harsh, probably. I'm betting. I haven't read all the reviews, but I'm just, my guess, knowing some music critics personally, is they're, they can be a little snooty. And so they described Spin Magazine, one of the snootier of the options out there, described So Close as, quote, overproduced and butchered, but did say, quote, To hear what a gorgeous song this really is, check out the acoustic version that's also on the album.
So close, yet so far away. So close, yet so far away. We believe in tomorrow, in a better day. Then we lie down to sleep, so close. Yet so far away.
Oh, I forgot that there were two of them on there, yeah.
What's your pick?
So my pick from the same album is Starting All Over Again.
Starting all over again. It's gonna be right.
Gonna be right.
So right.
So right.
So tight. We gonna make it.
Gonna make it one more time. Yeah.
Starting all over again. Oh. Gonna be tough.
And you know it's true.
Oh,
and it's actually a redo of a 1972 song by the cousin duo Mel and Tim. It's the title track of their second LP, and it was their second and final top 40 hit in the U.S. It charted at number 19 on the Billboard Hot 100. For Hall & Oates, it didn't chart anywhere on the Hot 100, which is kind of weird for me. You know, I'm doing these deep dives, and I think it's something we're going to look at in a future episode maybe, but what determines where the songs land and what charts they land on? When Hall & Oates did it, it was again on that Change of Season album, released as a single in 91, but it never charted on the Hot 100. It did reach number 10 on the U.S. Adult Contemporary chart during the summer of that year. But you know, it kind of goes back to their roots. You know, the early 70s, they were influenced so much by that Philadelphia sound. And that was, of course, a Campbell and Huff song.
I think my final pick's going to be this song from 2003. See if you remember this one.
Do it for money. I won't do it for pride. I won't do it to please somebody else. And it don't feel right. But I'll do it for you. And at least I'll try.
Yeah, that's Do It For Love. And that's the title track off their 16th studio album. 16.
Wow.
It seems like a low number, come to think of it.
So when you think of 16, you think, wow, that's a lot. But then when you figure their career has been 50 years.
Yeah.
It's like when they should have, maybe 16, they should have called it quits in 2003. Right. And then they're just touring with their body of work that they made during that 30-year span.
Yeah.
So 16 albums. 30 years, not too bad.
Sure. It peaked at number one on the Adult Contemporary chart, making it the eighth number one hit of their career. Although I don't know if you really can call number one on the Adult Contemporary a number one. Yeah, it's not the same as Hot 100, but still.
Somebody was listening to it, right? Somebody was buying it.
Sure, yeah. The last song I wanted to honor, and the one that we'll close this show with, they did a song, and again, off of Change of Season. That really is an album that I think I'm going to go buy. That's going to be my parting gift to Daryl and John, is I'm going to go back. I'm going to buy Change of Season because it seems like it's full of amazing songs. We're going to end this song with the song Don't Hold Back Your Love. It's written by Richard Page from Mr. Mister, Gerald O'Brien, and David Tyson. It is, oddly enough, the second most performed song in Canada during 1992.
Wow.
And the album itself was the final gold album for Hall & Oates. Guys, we're going to miss you. Have a great retirement. Enjoy your solo careers. And thanks for all the amazing hits. In the meantime, Chuck and I remain here, hopelessly stuck in the 80s.
Stuck in the 80s is now on Patreon. If you'd like to support the show, go to patreon.com/stuckinthe80s podcast. Special thanks to Check Battery Daily for our theme music, and thanks for listening.